The serve, sliced, backhand return. Rafa with a backhand volley, and it's over. Game, set, and match. His third U.S. Open Men's Singles Championship.
Sloan from deep beyond the baseline plays a backhand. Keys a forehand. Sloan just hammering away. Now steps into a forehand. It hangs over. Forehand netted by Keys, and Sloan Stephens is the 2017 U.S. Open champion. A warm hug at the net between the two friends.
Here comes a big smile with Sloan. She can't believe it.
Welcome to Courtside, the official podcast of the U.S. Open, as we continue our celebration of 50 years of the U.S. Open. I'm Steve Flink, and our guest on this podcast was inducted at the International Tennis Hall of Fame in July of 2017 and honored for a sterling career as the best American men's tennis player of his generation. Andy Roddick is, in fact, the last American man to win a Grand Slam singles title, realizing that extraordinary feat in 2003 with a popular victory at the U.S. Open when he was only 21. But that was not Andy's only substantial accomplishment. He finished 2003 as the number one ranked player in the world, no mean feat when you consider that his closest rival was none other than Roger Federer. He also spent 9 consecutive years, from 2002 through 2010, among the top 10 in the world. Moreover, Andy was instrumental in leading the United States to victory in the Davis Cup in 2007. His career concluded fittingly at the 2012 U.S. Open. Through it all, he was an unflagging competitor and a top-of-the-line professional. Andy, thanks for joining me on this podcast as we celebrate the 50th anniversary of Open Tennis and the U.S. Open.
Yeah, no problem. I'm happy to be on with you, Steve.
So, Andy, let's go back to 2000. You're the top junior in the world. The next year, you made a big leap up to number 14 in the world in the men's game at the age of 19. And that was the year that you played a really memorable, riveting contest against the indefatigable Leighton Hewitt of Australia. You lost it in 5 sets under the lights. But what did you take away from that experience to come so close to beating the number one player in the world who also went on to win the title?
I think my takeaways are twofold. I obviously was playing great tennis that tournament, and looking back, I think I was actually playing well enough to win. After that match where I lost to Leighton, he went on and kind of went right through. I think it was Kafelnikov in the semis, and he went through Pete pretty easily in the final.
Yeah, that's true, because they went had a tiebreaker in the first set, and then the last two sets were 1-1.
Yeah, so I could confidently say that I was probably, the end of that match was a little dicey with Leighton. I lost my composure a little bit. I've seen replays, so I did get a rough call on the way to getting broken in that fifth set, and I definitely didn't handle it. I handled it like I was a kid.
Well, you were still pretty young.
Yeah. So, maybe a little bit of a lack of experience or composure, but I certainly let it get away from me. But I don't think it's a stretch to say, looking back, I was maybe the second best form of anyone in that tournament, except for Leighton. And, had I maybe handled it better, maybe gotten a bit of a not as much of a unlucky break, I actually feel like I was probably playing good enough tennis to maybe win that tournament. And so, looking back at the end of the year, it's tough to kind of be objective when you're in the moment and emotions are present. But I took away a lot of good things following that tournament.
So yeah, so there was really more positives than negatives, because at the time, obviously, that was an emotional moment. The umpire overruling on the far sideline, a match that maybe you could win, but it sounds like you sorted it out over time.
Yeah, I don't know if I did or not. I know that my confidence was pretty high after that tournament. Going into it, I had played well. I had beaten Guga that summer, who was number one in the world, so it was my first win over number one. I had won DC pretty handily and beaten some pretty strong veterans there. So, 2001 went a lot faster than I thought it would. I didn't expect to win 3 tournaments straight out of juniors or, leave a Grand Slam thinking, I might have been able to win this if the circumstances were a little bit different. So, 2001 overall was a big year for me, and I certainly didn't leave the juniors thinking it would happen that fast.
So, Andy, obviously that was a big moment, first big quarterfinal at a major, and now a year later, you really established yourself, and now you're playing Pete Sampras in the quarters, and you'd had some tough physical battles leading into that, and Pete seemed to really peak that night. under the lights against, he was very inspired. The crowd was largely in his corner. How did it feel to be playing him under those circumstances? Two Americans, but most of the crowd rooting for Pete.
Yeah, I never ever expected to or thought that I deserved the crowd support when I was playing against Peter Andre. You know, they had made the men's side of that tournament for so long. You know, for I guess the entire 90s almost. And so, you know, I was never bitter about crowd support when I was playing one of those guys, or even, you know, a lot of times they get the scheduling benefits. They play the first night match, you play the second night match, you know, you're up late. And those are all, I think they call those paying your dues. You know, and I certainly understood the market that they had created that I was kind of getting put into. So not for one second did I care who the crowd was going for. You know, it's always nice to have support, but you know, it was a, I liked using the crowd in New York, so I didn't have that tool that night.
Yeah.
But, you know, I don't know that I think the crowd was the least of my concerns. Pete went right through me. I had actually had a good record against him. I think I was 2-0 against him at that point. You know, I'd beaten him in Miami and in Houston, but I also think that I naively made the mistake of thinking that those were the same as a U.S. Open version of Pete Sampras. So he came out, he was inspired. He had a huge chip on his shoulder, and probably rightfully so. I'd say the coverage from the media probably bordered on disrespectful. You know, him coming out of the summer and taking a loss to George Bastl, and you know, he read the letter from his wife at Wimbledon, and caught some really bad press, some personal press, and it was almost like for a moment in time people had kind of forgotten how good he was capable of playing. You know, so there were certainly a lot of questions, and he played that whole tournament like a pissed off teenager, and he just went right through me.
Yeah, well, that's a good description. And in turn, I mean, the circumstances were such that, you know, even on a windy night, it just seemed like everything was working for him, and he's chipping that approach to your forehand and coming in at the right times, and it was a pretty impressive performance. And but for you, it must have been tough, especially, I remember at the end, you kind of put your hands up. The crowd was getting all worked up when he was trying to serve the match out in the last game in the third set. And I remember you're kind of raising your hands as if to say, hold on, everybody, quiet down a little bit. The match isn't quite over yet. Do you remember that?
I actually don't, but it sounds like something stupid that I might have done back then.
So, Andy, let's go to the big year 2003, and as we come to your remarkable run through the field that year, and when you sort of define your greatness in many ways, and that puts you into an elite category as a major champion. But before we get to those extraordinary exploits in New York, I want to reflect on the astonishing summer you had, because first, you know, you started working with Brad Gilbert and you won at Queen's Club, saved a match point against Agassi there, and went on to take the title. At Wimbledon, you're in the semis and you ran into a top of the line Federer. Then you really had a magnificent hard court stretch where you won Indianapolis, lost a tough semi to Henman in D.C., and then won those Masters 1000 titles in Montreal and Cincinnati. So you'd won three of four hardcourt tournaments and four out of your last six events leading up to the Open. How much confidence did you have as you came to New York when you consider all those facts, and what did that make you feel about your chances of winning the Open that year?
Well, it was a strange thing, because I was rolling after Cincinnati, and I was playing great, but also I was playing great in tough circumstances. You know, I was winning I was winning the close matches when I had to. I beat Roger in Canada in a third set breaker. I won a third set breaker in the finals of Cincinnati, but I was going into those tough moments thinking I'm going to come out the other side. I remember getting to New York, and I that might have been actually the only time in my career where I was the legitimate favorite going into a slam. Even the next year when I was number one in the world going into Australia, I think most people would have said Roger's the favorite. You know, so going into the 03 Open, I felt like I was the best player in the world.
So was that a burden? Was that a burden in any way, or did you?
No, not. I mean, I was fine. I'd rather have that position than kind of trying to find something. But then the draw comes out, and I play Henman, and he's the only guy I'd lost to on a hard court that summer. And I play him first round, so the draw comes out, and I'm going, "Oh, this really sucks." You know, I'm playing great, but I'm also playing somebody who is not. You know, he wasn't seated top 32, but he was still a top 15 player in the world.
Right.
In my estimation. I think he had maybe gotten hurt and taken some time off, and he was playing great. I mean, he made the semis of the French Open the next spring. So, you know, I'm going, oh my God, I could win this thing legitimately, but I could also lose first round. So, it was a stressful week because I knew I had to get past that first one, and then.
So, what was the difference? What was the difference between the loss you had to him in DC and the way you played him against the DR? Did you learn something from the match in DC?
I don't know. I don't think so. I think it was just a matter of executing on a given day, and I got through some squirrely tiebreakers, and I think in DC he kind of got out of jail. I want to say I had a match point, and. There wasn't much between them. I think it was after I'd gotten through that match. And then, I mean, it might have been the toughest first two opponents I've ever played in a Grand Slam back-to-back. I had to play Henman and then played an unseeded Ivan Ljubicic.
Yeah, who, of course, was a big server and an aggressive player. So. And then something – talk about – there was some incident because I remember you sort of worked it out with him afterwards. It was a highly charged, kind of a heated match, and you won 7-6 in the fourth. What are your recollections on that one? Because it was a tough battle.
Yeah, so let me preface everything I'm about to say with Ivan and I are great now. You know, there are a lot of things that happened 15 years ago, and I certainly was tougher to maybe like then, especially on tour. You know, so I certainly raise my hand and accept my part in any incident back then. But I just don't think Ivan liked me very much. We had played in Cincy, and I certainly was kind of in your face at the time, and there was a lot of hype around me, and you know, he certainly had earned his stripes on tour and was a veteran. So it set the stage in New York, and I used the crowd that night. I'm sure he might not have appreciated it. We didn't actually get into it after the match or during the match. I had to answer questions about his comments in press.
That's right.
You know, so I was a little blindsided by it. You know, I'm for better or worse, I'm always happy to have a face-to-face conversation. You know, I'm certainly available, and I'm, you know, I wish it would have gone down like that. I don't know if Ivan, probably now he knows me a little bit better, probably would tell you now that might have been an option at the time.
Yep.
You know, so we I kind of got blindsided in the press, and I was a little pissed off. You know, I think he made allusions where I wasn't that good, and if I wasn't in America, then, you know, I couldn't play elsewhere, anywhere outside the States. And, you know, I at that point, I had a hard time believing that you get to 3 or 4 in the world and number one in the race without having to, you know, I had made the semis of 2 slams in 2 different countries that year. So I think I said something like it was sour grapes, or he just seemed angry, or I definitely didn't back down from it, and I'm glad I didn't. I don't think I should have. But I don't know. Who knows? He was pissed off at me. I was probably pissed off at him, and, you know, 15 years later, it doesn't matter at all.
But I see exactly. But I guess I only bring it up because it struck me that when these incidents happened, even including the one with Djokovic many years later, that you really like to sort of meet it head on, that you were pretty honest, and that you kind of like to, I always felt like you really wanted to resolve this. You didn't want any lingering animosity if you could help it.
Yeah, I guess so. I'll be the first to say what my first instinct is in high tension situations is to kind of get in there.
Yeah.
But I think when the emotions are running high, I'm probably a little irrational. And once it calms down, I feel like I can normally see both sides. And, you know, I feel like I can call it like I see it and be a little bit objective about myself. And, emotions weren't high. I was an emotional player. I think by the time I stopped playing, people understood it, you know, maybe a little bit better than they did early in my career. And I probably was a little bit better about knowing what the line was and how to kind of stay away from crossing it.
Yeah, because, I mean, again, just to bring up another quick thing, I remember Lars Graf telling me once about when he was he moved on from the chair, became a supervisor, or he was transitioning to it, and he had to come to you about a fine. And you came up to him and you said, Lars, you don't have to say anything, just give it to me. I'll pay it. It's my fault, which I thought said a lot about you.
Or it was just such an obvious offense that I didn't want to waste time. but yeah, I mean, I don't know. I mean, that's a nice story, and I certainly remember that moment. But I probably deserved it, you know. I didn't need to go to the principal's office and discuss it for an hour. It's just let's rip the bandaid off. Let me know what I owe, and let's move on.
Yeah, fair enough. So Andy, let's move on with that 2003 Open. So after the Ljubicic match, you really kind of marched on to the semis. So you got on a roll, and you were beating everybody in straight sets, and then you found yourself down two sets to David Nalbandian. Talk about that one, because eventually you had to save a match point in that third set tiebreak with a 138-mile-an-hour bomb of a serve, and you came all the way back to win it. But talk about what he was throwing at you that day and why it was so tough to beat him.
Well, it was a little bit weird. I remember I think I beat Malisse in the round of 16 and then Schalken in the quarters, but there was a lot of time between those two matches just because of weather. And it became kind of a screwy tournament. And I think I actually played Friday, Saturday, Sunday to win the tournament. And
yeah, you know, tough way to do it.
I got into it, and I just played a ton of tennis. And David just kind of had me a little bit of a sleeper hold. I felt like I should have won the first set. I felt like I was the better player. Didn't really capitalize. It was kind of completely backwards to the way my entire summer had gone. And then all of a sudden, he broke me out of nowhere in the second. And I'm going, oh my gosh, like this is a nightmare. Just tried to hang on, and maybe it was a lesson learned from the previous 2 years that we had talked about. You know, against Pete, I'd certainly let it get away from me, and he just ran right through me. And you know, Nalbandian, that probably could have easily been a straight set win for him. I kind of just toughed it out and got through that third set breaker, and then the momentum shifted very quickly. I don't know if he was pretty tired. He might have had to play Thursday and Friday. I definitely felt like my legs had more in them than his did. We get to the fifth set, and you know, he gets a call that probably wasn't great for him to break serve. You know, at that point, I feel like I had control of the match, but that doesn't necessarily always equate to winning. There is an element of timing and, you know, opportunity and a lot of other things that go into a match as opposed to just feeling like you're the better player. So,
and this time, of course, you certainly had the crowd fervently behind you in this case as the American. I mean, how much of a role do you think they played in sort of igniting you and getting your adrenaline?
Well, it was huge, and I don't think – I think they liked me just fine at that point. I think I was still – I think they were still trying to make their mind up about what they thought about me.
Yeah.
But I think an undersold factor of the crowd really getting behind me in that Nalbandian match is that Andre had lost. So – I was
yes,
he
lost to Ferrero, exactly. Yeah,
exactly. So I was the only hope. So for better or worse, they had to get behind me. So I definitely used him and got through. And then it's, you know, that match finishes, and it's, you know, I don't think maybe people don't realize, like, you have blisters on your feet, you've been playing, you play five sets, and as soon as you're done, it's going, oh my gosh, I have to put myself together again. And I don't know what time he finished. It had to be 7 or 8 at night, and the finals at 4 the next day. It's like, okay, you got to figure out food, you got to figure out treatment, you got to figure out how this is all going to fit into the jigsaw puzzle so that you can get enough sleep. All the while, you're trying to think of, hey, I hope I can sleep because I'm so excited about tomorrow. And oh, by the way, you're playing the guy that has just beaten Andre and will be the number one player in the world the next Monday. So it's a bit of a whirlwind. Kind of turning it around from Super Saturday to Sunday.
So how did you manage it? I mean,
the thing I'm about to tell you, I think it was a blessing in disguise. There was so much happening, and there was no idle time to sit around and think about what was going on. I knew I had form. I knew I was, you know, in really great shape. I knew I was in match shape. I had been playing matches, you know, for the last 2.5 months, pretty much every other day or every day, except for, you know, I might have taken a week or two off. So I knew I had form. I wasn't going to go out and lay an egg with form. I knew the nerves wouldn't affect me like that. I knew my serve would get me through tense moments. It all went so fast that I all of a sudden it's, you know, 3:40 before 4 o'clock start, and I think that's when it hits me. I'm going, oh my gosh, this is like, it's a U.S. Open final, and I'm the guy walking out of the tunnel. I've been watching this match for 15 years already. So
was that kind of surreal then?
Yeah, I think that's when it kind of got – I was really loose. I was hitting, you know, I think Brad and I were doing batting practice during warm-ups, and it was all pretty kind of – pretty loose. And then there were two moments I got nervous where we're walking off the practice court, and Brad kind of gave me a fist bump, and he goes, impose your will on this guy. And I'm like, oh, God, okay, we got to – I'm about to go do this. And then right before, you know, when they have the live feed going, and you see, you know, for me, they drape the American flag over the court, and they kind of go through the whole thing, and it all was very patriotic, and I'm going, oh man, this is on me.
Well, you certainly responded, Andy. I mean, straight sets 3-6 and 3, and second set obviously was the pivotal one. But what did you think was the key to your beating the man who had just handled Agassi the day before, and Ferrero had demonstrated against Agassi that he certainly was a formidable hard court player? So what was the difference?
Tennis is all matchups. I mean, you get to a certain level and everyone can, you know, you get to the top of the game and everyone is capable of beating anyone, correct? And it becomes matchups. And I don't think I gave Juan Carlos any rhythm. I think he would have rather played Andre, and Andre, you know, obviously was a better player than I ever was. But in the match against Andre, he got to get in and hit balls. And I don't know what I served. I think I served 30-something aces that day. Or 20 some. I just remember thinking, this guy can't even touch my serve. He's not even getting into return games. And so that kind of freed me up. In the first couple games,
did that surprise you, Andy? He's a great returner. No,
because he's a great returner, but he likes time. You know, Andre was a great returner, but he was happy with the ball coming quick to him. You know, he was a timing returner, where JCF kind of, I guess, felt his returns a little bit more. I came out, and the first couple ground strokes I hit were crisp. I hit a winner. I hit a forehand. I remember early in it was an inside-in forehand that I kind of just stepped into and kind of took on the short hop, and it just came off clean. I don't know that I was trying to hit a winner, and it ended up by him, no problem. I'm going, all right, I got something today. And so I felt like I was in control of that the whole time. And even my nerves were – I was almost catatonic. Like, I was just kind of cruising through, and I didn't actually use the crowd that much that day because I didn't want anything to change from the way it started. You know, it's weird. There's no need to use the crowd if everything's going perfectly. So I didn't. And then when he double-faulted – and I actually felt that he was going to double-fault at that point. And part of me was hoping he was going to double-fault, but it was a 3-4 in the third set, and then all of a sudden – I'm really glad I didn't have a switch over to think about serving the match out. You know, he double faults. I'm a little nervous. The first serve, there's an ace, and then it's just rolling from there. You know, there's a huge difference when you're trying to serve it out between 15 love and love 15, especially on the as far as your emotions go. So
might have been a different feeling if it had gone to 4-4 and you break for 5-4 and you have to sit at the changeover, right?
Well, yeah, you're you know, the thing that's fascinating about tennis, and I don't need to tell you because you're the human encyclopedia, but you know, it's being alone with your thoughts is one of the most fascinating things about tennis. And the way that different players, and I'm probably a little more honest about the way that I digested my thoughts than most are, but it's all different. It's also fascinating. And I'm glad, you know, you turn around Saturday to Sunday. I didn't have time to sit and think. And I didn't have time to sit and think before I went and served the match out. And, you know, it went pretty cleanly.
So, Andy, I remember you being in joyful tears when it was over. But when you had the time to reflect, it's an odd thing for me to say, I guess, but didn't you feel you deserved it? I mean, you really had been through this stretch from Queens right through the Open, winning 5 out of 7 tournaments. You really had been the best player in the world, and you'd even beaten Roger in that phase in Canada. Mm-hmm. Come back from 2-4 down the third to beat him. I mean, didn't it dawn on you that you really had earned it?
Yeah, I thought so. I look back at, in even when I was ranked number one, I don't know that I thought I was better than Roger, but I think you're right. That summer, for that, you know, 2.5 month stretch or whatever it was, I think that's the time where I was the best player in the world.
And Andy, what you referred to Brad, that was a very successful start to a coaching player partnership. What did he instill in you? Why do you think it took off that way from the moment go?
He's just on you from, you know, you wake up at 7:30 and he's in your ear with something positive. And you know, Brad is a great strategist. You know, he really, you know, I always used to joke with him. I'm like, I don't know if you can finish the alphabet, but no one's smarter between the lines.
Yeah.
You know? And so, right. And he, you know, he just saw things a different way. I think his tone was different. I think he was able to simplify things. He didn't make tennis seem overly complicated. It was like, listen, we're going to try this. If it doesn't work, you know, revert to this, you know, and it was all pretty straightforward. And I think, you know, when you get off to a good start in a new coaching relationship, and it was really hard to start. I mean, I needed Brad at that time just because I had one of the toughest days of my professional life, my personal life was breaking up with my coach before him, Tariq Benhabiles. And he was stayed in Paris after I lost first round of the French Open. I was in London and I knew that I was going to go a different direction. I just felt like we were grinding on each other. And, you know, I didn't know if Brad would take the job yet, but I actually got on a train to go have a face-to-face conversation with Tariq. I didn't want to have that conversation over the phone. And so my entire day was pretty much spent on a train except for kind of, you know, breaking this man's heart and, you know, blowing up our relationship. So to come out of that and have someone – tennis was like a great place to be at that point. You know, when I was between the lines, I wasn't thinking about, I guess, negative emotional stuff or stuff that was hard personally. And so, you know, Brad was a great outlet at that moment.
So when the time came that you split up with Brad, was that also very emotional and a lot of turmoil inside? Was that tough, let's say, at the end of 2004 when you made that choice?
Yeah. Yeah. And it's probably not one that I'll talk about, too deeply. You know, it probably wasn't the right move professionally at that point. You know, but it was something that I felt had to be done. And you know, I'm Brad and I are fine. You know, it was probably a little chippy for a while, and especially he comes back and he's with Murray, and you know, we probably wanted to kill each other for a little while. But we're great now, and you know, obviously I was inducted alongside of you in Newport, and I needed Brad to be there, even though our relationship probably isn't as close personally as my other former coaches. I certainly understand, am thankful for, and respect what he did for my tennis career. He was there for the best of it.
Absolutely. Well, that's an interesting assessment. I appreciate that. But Andy, let's look at the years following to the breakthrough at the Open in 2003. And in 2004 and 2005, you had really good years. You know, you're runner-up to Roger both years at Wimbledon, and you finished 2004 at number two, and you're number three at the end of 2005. You were right up there. But then you come into 2006, and there were some struggles in the first half. But then over the summer, you really got going, and Cincinnati was a turning point, and that's when along came Jimmy Connors. So talk about the lead-up to that Open and the nice run you had to the final of the 2006 U.S. Open with Jimmy Connors as your coach, and the role that he played in helping you with your resurgence.
Yeah, I struggled at the – it's weird. I've never felt – or sorry, to that point in my career, I had never felt fitter going into a year in 2006. Got off to an average start in Australia. Then I had some kind of knick-knack things that, you know, I didn't like talking about my injuries unless I had to. You know, unless it was obvious. You know, so I kind of got into a little bit of a tailspin, and all of a sudden I lose to this kid who at the time I thought I never should have lost to in the third round of Wimbledon, who ended up being a guy named Andy Murray.
Yeah.
you know, looking back, that doesn't look like a bad loss on paper. But anyways, it was like Wimbledon, forever and a day, you know, I could come off of the French and – you know, the grass court season was like my pacifier. I felt comfortable. I knew that I was going there. I would go underground from Paris on the train. As soon as we saw light again, I was one of the best players in the world again because the surface had changed and the circumstances had changed. And, you know, Queens was a place I felt great, and I didn't play great there. I lost to James. And then, you know, and then I lost in 06 to Murray. I'm going, oh my God, I think I dropped out of the top 10, which, you know, for me, it was just a given at that point in my career that I was you know, most of the time I was top five and, you know, definitely top 10. And so I dropped out of there. And then I was playing Daniel Brocchiali. And I had gotten hurt again that summer after Indy in L.A. So I'd taken a couple weeks off, didn't play in Toronto, come back in Cincy. And I was match point down there. If I lose that, just to tell you, like, the margins between something really great happening and what we actually remember and what the reality was in a given moment.
Yeah.
I lose that point to Brachiali. I'm outside the top 20, probably floundering going into the U.S. Open. I turn that match around, find some form. By the end of Cincinnati, I played Ferrero again, beat Andy Murray in that tournament, which he had, you know, been really good and had some really quality wins. And I went to the Open thinking, man, you know, outside of Roger, I think I'm the guy to beat. That was one of my most fun tournaments because I had my first dose of – I was 23 years old at the time, or 24 years old. And I'd already gotten like, well, who's after Andy? Who's the next guy? Who's the future of American tennis? And I'm going, I'm 24 years old and I've won this tournament before. You know, it's like,
yeah.
And I've been in a Grand Slam final every year for the last 3 years. You know, it was amazing to me that I was having to defend that. You know, so I was kind of pissed off going into that tournament, but I also loved that run. It was so much fun. I beating Leighton in a slam was a big deal for me.
That Verdasco win was a good one in the third round. Tough match, 5 sets.
I mean, he's capable of taking the racket out of your hands some days, and especially back then. It was a run that I had as much fun during that 06 run as I did during the 03 run, because it wasn't a given that I was going to be in the final. You know, if you look 2 months earlier, it was the complete opposite of 03. You know, all the way in the lead, and I'm going, I can win this thing. 3 weeks before that U.S. Open, I'm going, I don't even know if I can win a match. I'm in a tailspin. And so just, you know, things can change so quickly, and it does show you how much is between the years.
Absolutely. But, Andy, obviously you're the one who had to go out there and do it. You're the one who's got to pull those matches out and fend off Verdasco in the fifth set and beat Hewitt. How did Connors inspire you? I remember at the time, we heard a lot about him work, sort of emphasizing your back end down the line and things like that, and he seemed to have a great belief in you, genuinely. So what did he instill? How did he as a coach, obviously a very different approach from Gilbert, but what would you say that Jimmy did particularly well during that phase to help you believe in yourself?
Yeah, frankly, it's just different when Jimmy Connors is saying something.
You know, yeah.
It just comes across differently. If someone with his pedigree looks you in the eye, and there's probably more expletives involved with what he said versus what I'm going to repeat it as, but yeah. Like, get in there, do it. You can beat these, you know, yep. Whatever he decided to call them.
Yep.
It was the most inspired I had been by someone. You know, Brad was unbelievable X's and O's. He knew everybody backwards. He knew, listen, they might do this, but under pressure, they're going to do this. Look for this ball. Make him force the ball line under pressure. That's not his natural swing path. And, you know, so his was way more in-depth as far as strategy. And Jimmy didn't even know the guys. He hadn't been around tennis for 20 years. You know, 20 years is a stretch, but he hadn't been around tennis for 10 years.
Yeah.
And didn't know half the guys I was playing. You know, so I'm relying on my scouting reports, and Jimmy's just, you know, he's telling me, listen, use the crowd. Get into it. Bring him in with you. Invite him into the theater. They're going to get behind you. You know, and it was different because the year before at the Open, I had laid the ultimate egg against Muller. So, I was trying to win them over all over again. And so I think Jimmy really just was inspirational. And he was like, you know, he was Jimmy Connors, and that's, you know, I feel like I was getting pushed by him. So it was pretty fun. And obviously the hype around everything and the interest that you guys had in what we were doing, it was all exciting again. You know, it wasn't this kind of drudgery that I had been going through for the first half of the year. Everything was new, everything exciting. We arrived on site and there was a buzz around it. And it really fed me that tournament.
And the chemistry was right?
The chemistry, it's weird. I love Jimmy. I mean, I got a phone call from him 5 nights ago, and it was 11:30 at night here. We spent a lot of our time in this little North Carolina mountain town with 2 stoplights. And we were here, and my phone rings, and it's an unknown block number, and I don't normally answer, and I did. And it was Jimmy going, man, we were talking about you today. Just wanted to say I was thinking about you. How are you? And I don't think a lot of people hear those stories about Jimmy. You know, it's probably the – you hear the other side of the stories about Jimmy. And so for some reason, we've always had a really, really genuine and unique friendship. And I don't know if it was a generational thing. I don't think he let people like Andre or Jim Curry or, you know, people that I'm close with. And I'm going, man, you know, in another lifetime, you guys would have been friends. I promise you. I know both of you really well. You know, and they just don't click. And maybe it was just because I wasn't a contemporary. He never had to beat me. I never had to try to play him. But we've always just gotten along really well. And even if we haven't seen each other or talked to each other for a while, as soon as we see each other, it's like we talk every week. It's, you know, it's, I've always had just a really, really fun, special relationship with Jimmy.
So Andy, let's go on to the move to the 2007, which was a phenomenal Davis Cup year for you. And obviously that was a big deal because the U.S. hadn't won it since 95 and you were unstoppable that year, and you had a couple wins against the Czech Republic, including over Burdich, and then beat Verdasco when the U.S. toppled Spain, and then over beat Johansson and Bjorkman as the U.S. beat Sweden, and finally came to Portland and beat Tursunov, and the U.S. took the cup. Explain what that meant to you, committing to all four rounds and being really the springboard, being the man. I mean, obviously, you had a lot of help from the Bryans. You had James. There were a lot of guys contributing, but you really were the key to it all. And what did that mean to you?
You know, it was weird because everything in my career came quickly, except for the Davis Cup title. You know, I'd never James and the Bryans and, you know, they had always been on teams. They had played college tennis. And for me, I didn't have that. And so I think they helped me grow up through the Davis Cup a little bit. And we had kind of taken it on the chin, but we took it on together and, you know, we kind of formed a brotherhood on the road, and there was that camaraderie, and you know, they became a huge part of my social existence on tour. So I was certainly I felt indebted to them. You know, I think they helped me grow up, but during the process of growing up, I think I became the leader of that team also. You know, I went out and wanted to do it, and you know going over and playing playing Burdich, that was on slow indoor clay, which didn't bounce very high, which is like my number one worst case scenario for playing a match. If it's not giving me some bounce on my shots, or and it's not going quick through the court, and it's wet and it's indoors, which I didn't really like, that was a huge win for me, and it kind of catapulted us into the season. But just the culmination of it being a home tie and, you know, winning on a home surface, and it was great. It was a dream come true, and it's something that we'll always be able to share together. That was a big, big moment for me, and it was a memory that I'll probably cherish as much as any of the other individual accomplishments.
Absolutely. Well, Andy, you know, there's a brief detour to, and I hate to do this to you, but I wanted to just talk about Wimbledon 09 in the context of heartbreaking loss, yes, 16-14 in the fifth to Roger Federer. You don't lose your serve till the last game of the match, 14-15 in the fifth. Obviously, you won the first set and had your 6-2 lead in the second set tiebreak. But are you able now to look back on that and say, in the way that sort of McEnroe does with his loss to Borg in the 1980 Wimbledon final, where you can say to yourself, I gave it all I had, and people will remember that more as a triumph than a defeat, because you played, you lost so gallantly and so unluckily in many ways to Federer, because a lot of us thought you really outplayed him that day.
Yeah, I don't know. I have a weird relationship with that match. I think, taking a step back, I think there's far more positive that came out of that for me personally than negative. I think the tennis viewing public might have understood me a little bit better. You know, I certainly in early in my career, I was loud. I was flashy. You know, I was kind of in your face, and you know, I certainly acted regrettably sometimes. But below all that, I always went to work. I was humble about practicing. I put my work in. I felt like I led our team through example. I would hope my teammates said if there was ever a problem, I would be the first one at the front of the line to help. And you know, so I think after that match, for some reason, in a tough moment, I don't know. Maybe people just viewed me a little bit differently. But
I think they definitely did.
And it made the rest of my career more fun. You know, and who knows if you win that, and I actually wrote an excerpt, and a friend of mine is a radio guy named Bobby Bones, and he wrote a book called Fail Your Way to Success, and wanted me to write a chapter, so I kind of touched on this match a little bit. But the end goal was I had so many more great kind of mini interactions, whether it was with fans, whether it was with you all in the media. It was I didn't feel like we were butting heads anymore. I don't know. There, on a personal level, with all those conversations that happened afterwards, I think it was great, and I think I'm probably a better person today for having lost that match. But you know, you look back, and I had never watched it, and actually, a couple times this year, I got sucked into it at from like 10 all on about a month ago. And so, looking back, and I'd watched the breaker, the second set breaker, one time last year, and then I had to turn it off. So I've kind of seen, I don't know, moments of that match sporadically, just cause it's been on rerun on Tennis Channel or something. You know, so it's weird to digest it. It's weird to see kind of the differences with the way I remember it versus the way it presents on television.
Well, I'm glad to see you can look at it, that you remember so many of those positives and the response from the fans and the press, and I certainly remember it fondly, and I think of it as one of your really finest hours, right up there with the U.S. Open. But Andy, you know, 2010, you're still eight in the world, and then you slipped out of the top 10 the next year. By the end of 11, were you thinking of retirement already? Was it already starting to enter your mind that the next year might be it? What were your thoughts then?
No, I don't think so. I got hurt. I had a hard time with my hamstring, 2011, because in my mind, the only way that I could, there was a significant talent divide between me and the guys that I was trying to beat. What Rafa can do with the ball, what Novak can do with pacing of shots and getting the rally that he wants by switching directions, and you know, he was kind of coming on at that moment. I had played really well against him, but it was obvious that he was a different guy, and he was kind of entering this all-time stratosphere. Roger was still Roger. It's still a terrible matchup for me. So in my mind, I had to trim the margins by just really working hard and being on the track and being up and training for 2.5 hours in the morning on a track, and then getting my tennis reps in the afternoon, being diligent about treatment. And, you know, I definitely pushed the envelope physically. And if I had one thing that I could probably take back, it wouldn't be anything about any of the Wimbledons. It would be kind of tempering my workload and working smarter, not harder. But I got
kind of like Courier. Would you think that it was similar with him?
Yeah, I think we were. I think Jim and I are great, great, great friends to this day, and I think we probably relate to each other as far as what we were dealing with in our career. And he hit a kind of a sweet spot before prime Pete, and you know, before kind of prime Andre, I guess. But and he made the most of it. You know, there's not one person, Jim included, who would sit here and say I had more talent than those guys for those years. I think he maximized, and that's all I would ever want to try to do. And I certainly respect people who do maximize. Anyways, that offseason, I got banged up. I pulled a hamstring. I went to Australia, did it against Leighton, second round again. And it was, I made a series of bad choices trying to come back too soon. So 2012 was just, it was the first 6 months felt kind of gross. You know, yeah. It was just, I was either getting treatment or trying something new or coming back. And, you know, I needed reps. You know, what amazes me about Roger is, you know, he can not play for 6 months, come back and win an Australian Open without any match play. I wasn't that guy. I needed the reps. I needed to feel like I was kind of, I was a bit of a diesel engine. You know, it took me a second to get going. And it was just a struggle, you know, get through the French. And then I found some at Eastbourne, won it. So I kind of thought about it, like, listen, if I can't get healthy, I don't know what I'm doing out here. And I didn't want to just exist on tour. You know, my personal life never existed on tour. My social life never existed on tour. I had other business interests that I had already started while I was on tour and managing while I was playing. So I don't think retirement scared me, just because I knew I had a life already set up that I could go to very easily. Honestly, I didn't think about it much. It kind of crossed my mind, and it was more of a what if thing. But I decided the morning that I retired that I was going to retire.
On your birthday, right?
Yeah, I woke up in the morning and my shoulder hurt a little bit, and I knew that I'd probably have to have some sort of operation to put that back together, and I don't know what that entailed. And I was already nervous about a second round match that was 2 days away, and so I texted Brooke, and I was like, "You need to come back because I'm having some crazy thoughts." And so she came back, and we just kind of went through it. And I said, "Listen, I don't know if my body can hold up well enough to win a slam, and that's ultimately what I get up for in the morning." And I don't mean disrespect to smaller events, but I could have won 10 more 250s, and I don't know that people would have remembered my career any differently.
Yeah, I agree.
I'd won two out of my last four events, I think, with Eastbourne and Atlanta, so I was playing fine. I'd been hurt, so my ranking was low, but, at the time I retired, I felt like I was, probably top 15 as far as playing well, maybe top 10. I could probably get back there, but I don't know that I could go through the firing line of Murray, Djokovic, Prime Federer, Prime Nadal, and have my body go through those for 2 weeks. I didn't think I could. And, I was happy to kind of move into the next phase and be a better husband and have my focus be on that. Maybe enjoy some time before we decided to turn the page and have children of our own. And there was a lot going on with our foundation, which has become very successful. And I've been lucky enough to fall into some great business opportunities. I had a commercial real estate company while I was playing, and that's you wait long enough with real estate and you look smart. So there was stuff that I wasn't going to have a hard time finding something to do when I got out of bed in the morning. So I think that made my decision a lot easier.
And then what about, briefly, the emotions when you lost to Del Potro? Obviously, you knew it was coming to the end and the fourth set was slipping away. And
yeah.
Put that in perspective. I mean, obviously, he was a great player and had won the title. What were your feelings?
It wasn't any – I didn't think about matches. I didn't think about tennis, my career. I thought about people. I thought about my mom driving me to all these damn tennis practices, when I'm – 7-8 years old, and she spent her life in a car so I could play tennis. My agent had passed away the year before, and so all that he had done, and he would literally sit there, Steve, in a room with you, and he might have. I was 3-24 against Roger, and he would sit there in a room and lie to you and tell you that he thought I was better than Roger. Like he was that loyal to me.
And you talk about Ken Meyerson?
Yeah,
so great, good guy. I flew over to Wimbledon with him 1 year, and actually he had a watch. He showed me a watch that you had given him, and he was so thrilled by it. Oddly, he was not wearing it. He took it out of his briefcase to show me that you'd given it to him as a gift. I don't know if you remember that, but I had some great exchanges with him.
Yeah, he was a character. I said everyone probably has a bad story about Ken. Some people might have a good story about Ken, but everyone, I guarantee you, they have a funny story about Ken.
Yeah.
But I think I said that in Newport, but I thought about him. I wish he was there, and frankly, that was probably a big piece that was missing in 2012. That was tough for me. I mean, he died suddenly in his sleep, so I had some guilt. I busted Ken's ass. We were partners, but I had guilt about. I hope he knew how important he was to me. So that crossed my mind, and that made me emotional. And so there was that moment where you could see that I was kind of tearing up, and none of it really had to do with tennis. It was more the people that I had met through tennis. I look up and I saw my wife, and I had kind of met her and thrust her into this crazy world that we live in. And Doug Spreen, who's one of my best friends to this day, and Larry was up there. And there's a million people that get you to a point where you can potentially be successful. So I was thinking more about all of those people and the fans going crazy and what they had kind of gone through with me over time. I feel like I had met them when I was a kid, and now I was an adult, and so all of those things kind of go through your head, and not one of them was about any given match, or I wasn't melancholy about that being my last point, or I was at peace with that part. It was more just the people.
So Andy, a lighter note, hosting Saturday Night Live. Talk about that, that one time experience, and how what grade would you give yourself?
I don't know. Passing grade. That's what I was hoping for. The thing about that was you're doing 10 hours of rehearsals a day, but I also had to figure out a time to practice because year end masters was the next week. Later on in my career, there's no chance I would have accepted the hosting gig. But I was young, dumb, and did it, and somehow got away with the number one ranking also. you know, but I was practicing in the morning, eating lunch, and going straight to rehearsals until midnight. It was a pretty hectic week. You know, so I was kind of following orders. I was pretty neurotic. They have, you know, lines off camera that you can read, and I wanted to memorize all of them to save me from, you know, freezing or, you know, whatever on live television. So it was a pretty studied week. And you know, I remember rolling into Houston about 3 a.m. and like maybe a day and a half before I had to play. So I think with the kind of media machine from the 03 US Open, I was sufficiently running on fumes by the end of that tournament. And I think it probably showed once I secured the number one ranking. I think I was, I might have allowed myself to be tired.
So, Andy, let's go to the supreme honor last year in Newport. And having been around you a lot over the course of that week, I mean, I've seldom seen a player appreciate the honor more than you did. You know, was that? Do you look at that as sort of the capstone of your career? Because the way you spoke and embraced it, it was more visceral than most players, and your humility and appreciation just shine through that day.
Well, I don't know. You know, I'm going to say some things here, and it's not false modesty. It's honestly what I think. I wouldn't have voted myself in on the first ballot. There has to be some differentiation between someone like me and someone like a Roger, Rafa, Serena, Venus. You know, you go down the line. So I was pretty humbled. I probably felt like maybe it was a little bit too soon. I think my career stacks up favorably against people that are in. So I didn't feel undeserving. I knew I was, again, like when Roger stops, it's just a matter of time passing, right?
Sure.
For me to get that honor, it wasn't a given. It was never a given. So maybe it meant more to me just because of the gesture of not only letting me in, but all of a sudden I'm in on the first ballot. I was a little bit overwhelmed by that. I felt humbled by the sense of respect that the people voting gave me. And then again, I don't know that I talked about a match during my speech. I revert back to the feelings I was feeling when I retired, but it takes a lot of people to help you and to believe in you. And you know, also, you know, you think about your coaches who had young kids at home, but were sacrificing part of their life to be with you and to help you in your journey. At that point, you know, Hank was, our son was already with us, and our daughter Stevie was, you know, it was the first time kind of Brooke was showing. So I think people knew that we were pregnant for the first time, and I had mentioned it in my speech also. But the sacrifice that people made for me meant that much more to me that weekend, just because I had kids. I was a little naive before, you know. But it's humbling. I mean, you're a tennis historian. I'm certainly not on your level, but. You know, I'm walking through the museum, and it's like you see people that I grew up watching their matches. I can tell you, you know, about Lendl, and I can tell you about Becker. And these are the guys that I played on the rebound net in my garage when I was 7 or 8
sure.
9 years old.
Sure. And you made a reference to Lendl and Chang, which I thought was interesting in your speech. You know,
That was the first their match where the infamous underhand serve, yep. Chang cramping match. That was the first match I ever watched start to finish. In 1989, you know, so it was weird because I said during my speech, I was having a hard time connecting the childhood version of my tennis fandom to the reality that I get to hang out with them on quasi equal footing for the rest of my life. I mean, what's cooler than that?
Well, nothing. So, Andy, you're in closing. Obviously, we as I said at the outset, this podcast is sort of celebrating the 50th anniversary of Open Tennis and the U.S. Open, and obviously, it's been 15 years now since an American man has won that U.S. Open. You hold that distinction. What does this anniversary mean to you as a former champion? And what are some of your thoughts on the future of American tennis when you look at the likes of TFO, Donaldson, Fritz, and others right now who seem so promising?
Yeah, I mean, I think we're in a pretty good position. I think the only thing I would preach, and you know, you probably get like an eye roll because you get older and you preach work and you preach work ethic and treat it like, I just want all of, you know, the up and coming, any up and coming Americans, treat it like a job. That doesn't mean you can't enjoy it, but be responsible. You know, no one at a real job shows up late for work and doesn't get fired. You know, put in the time, put in the effort, be diligent, get your treatment. Never lose a match because you didn't get a massage or because you ate badly the day before or you're cramping in the third set, you know, because you haven't been disciplined or diligent with your fitness. You know, this is the thing I say, like, fitness is a choice. You know, playing well and talent and what you can do with a tennis racket isn't always a choice, but fitness is a choice. You can put in the hours and you can become as fit as you can possibly be. So I hope the next generation of Americans kind of take that to heart. I think we're in a good spot. I think, you know, we have some really good young prospects. And frankly speaking, we need that void filled, you know, before we lose Roger and Rafa and guys that can carry a night session in New York at the U.S. Open. So I'm pulling hard. I was hoping for that. I don't know when this podcast is going out, but we're however many days past Wimbledon, and I was pulling so hard for John. I kind of roll my eyes at the first final semifinalist since Andy in a Grand Slam, the first finalist at Wimbledon since I want those to be gone. And
yeah, you know, definitely.
I don't want to be relevant during a broadcast anymore.
Yeah, fair enough. That's a good way to look at it. But Andy, just tack onto that a little bit about how you feel about the role you played. I mean, because 50 years is a long span, and you played a prominent role by winning the U.S. Open in 2003. So how do you feel about the connection you have with the Open and the prominence that you achieved there, and what an important part of your career, the U.S. Open, how the U.S. Open fit into the context of your career?
Well, I mean, it goes without saying that the U.S. Open was way more important to me than I ever was to it. And that probably goes for any player, but, to win it, I went to my first U.S. Open in 1991. My mom took me up there as a birthday present. So we went. And I snuck into every match of Jimmy's for that entire run. And you leave that and you're just like, man, this is – I'd watched tennis on TV, but I think it took my fandom to another level. So I'm the kid who was sneaking into the matches. And then 12 years later, I was the guy winning the tournament. I don't know what words I can say to, you know – express how thankful I am for that tournament, whether I was a fan, whether I was a winner. I lost first round and I was the guy that was, you know, spoiled the party. So I've had every emotion at that tournament. So it's such a, I'm always obviously going to be referenced with it. It's part of my history, and I'm thankful for it.
Well, Andy, I knew this discussion today was going to be a lot of fun, but it's exceeded my expectations. I really appreciate all of your reflections on your career and having this chance to talk about it with you in depth. So thanks so much.
Well, I was looking forward to it. I know it was probably my doing, but we didn't talk too much during my career. So I'm having spent the weekend we spent last year in Newport, I'm glad we kind of finally got around to doing this.
Oh, it was great, Andy. It was terrific. Let's do it again sometime in the future.
All right. Sounds good. Thank you so much, Steve.
All right. Thanks, Andy. Thanks for listening to Courtside, the official podcast of the U.S. Open. I'm Steve Flink. Please join us every week as we count down to the 2018 U.S. Open.